You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Back, how did you get into boxing?
My father was a fighter in London. Reluctantly, I did what the owl had said.
Did you feel he forced you to box? Do you think you would have boxed if he didn't push you or influence you to box?
Never would have fought.
Really?
No. I mean, I might have tried it.
Did you feel like you had a natural instinct for it, or was something that you had to really work on?
My brother John, who actually won more amateur acclaim than I did, he was a better boxer than me, tougher, he was smaller than me. So he's a tougher man than me. So he was a great fighter, and I don't think he really liked it that much either, but he was more naturally, it came more natural to him. Me, I hated it when I was a kid. I'm also a recovered alcoholic. So for some reason, as alcoholics, we are very sensitive, you know, and the people ask you, why'd you quit fighting? I said, I became allergic to getting hit in the head, you know. but we did it, you know, because you're no choice, like, really, you know.
For a fella didn't like the sport, to go as far as you did, to eventually end up fighting Evander Holyfield. How does that happen?
It's a long story. I'll give you a brief synopsis of it. I ended up fighting with a Mayo team against a Chicago team in Chicago back in the 80s. And my father came over with me. So then I came back and he stayed there. And then he eventually moved to New York. And so in the early 80s, my sister Rosalind and I moved to New York. And I came from Enfield to Brooklyn, so it was quite a change, quite a shock. And it was great in the beginning, and then I got a job driving the horse and carriages around the park in Manhattan, and which was a great job and making a rake of money. And I was drinking a lot then, you know. I was really young, you know.
How old would you have been?
When I started the horse and carriages, I was about 20, yeah. And by the time I was 21, almost 22, I found myself drinking way too much and drove in a blackout and woke up one morning with a scar halfway on the sidewalk, halfway on the street, thinking, "What? I'm 21, what am I doing? I'm ruining my life, I can't stop drinking." So I swore off drinking.
Were you also boxing alongside Dallas?
I had been in the Golden Gloves 2 years before that. I lost in the quarterfinals, usually to the eventual winner actually both times, and it was a very close fight too. I'm a real boxer. We never get beat. No one can ever beat us. You know, we're always robbed. So that year, I started training on January 4th for the Golden Gloves, and they start February. So February 1st was my first fight.
Not a lot of time.
No, yeah. But back then you're young. I was 20, 21, or maybe 22 at the time. 22. But the previous years, I had like 11 fights over the 3 years in the Golden Gloves. I never got a decision because I was always with the wrong club. That's political stuff. So I started fighting, and I knocked all the guys out in 85 for the to win the title, you know, win the heavyweight title. I was really only a cruiserweight because I only weighed 190. But I forget your question, Andy.
How did you lead up? So you've won the Golden Gloves.
Yes.
You work your way up to be a contender.
Yeah.
In the cruiserweight division.
I was really a cruiserweight,
yeah. You were ranked number 3 in the world at one stage.
Yeah,
Then you move up to heavyweight.
Well, what happened was I took a fight against a guy named Cecil Coffey. I had a very good record. I think he was 19-2 with 18 knockouts. And initially when I saw the record, I said, gee, why am I fighting this guy, you know? So I looked at the tape and said, I can beat that fella, you know? And it was a tough fight. Won that fight well. But a great, very exciting fight. And I fought a guy named Michael Greer. He was world-ranked also. And then they, all of a sudden, they had me ranked number 9 in the world as a heavyweight, but 3 as a cruiserweight. So in February or so of 1990, the biggest shock in boxing history, the invincible Mike Tyson gets knocked out by Buster Douglas. So threw the whole boxing world on its head, because the biggest fight of the year of the century was supposed to be, or any of the decade, was supposed to be Holyfield against Tyson. So I guess they looked in the rankings. They saw they had a huge following on the East Coast of America. So they asked me to fight Holyfield. And we said, I'm not going to fight Holyfield. I'm a cruiserweight. He's the number one in the world heavyweight. And they came back a week later and they says, okay, but if you beat him, you'll make $25 million in your next fight. So we had to take it, you know.
Would that have potentially been against Tyson?
No, because Buster Douglas was the champion.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. See, then I actually did. I didn't do great against Holyfield, but I got him a few slaps.
And tell me, it's the night Douglas beat Tyson. A night which ended up having huge implications for you in your life.
Yes.
Where were you that night?
I was actually watching it in Staten Island at the Buchanan's, which is behind my girlfriend's house, the Rossi. She was Rossi. In February of 1990, yeah.
No idea that this was going to play all out and you were going to play a role in this.
Exactly, yeah. So so we had the fight was set up and we didn't have really enough time to get ready, but we was fine, so I was in good shape. But mentally I wasn't prepared at all, you know, and all that attention. I mean, I was talking to Trump, and I was talking to, not that I wanted to talk to him, but I was talking to all these people and all these interviews and all these phone calls. It's like, you know what it's like, Andy, the barrage
Did Trump say to you?
He actually came into the dressing room after the fight, and he says, you put up a great fight. He says, we want you to fight here again, because a lot of people came down to see me, you know?
Yeah.
So
it was a great fight in terms of, well, Holyfield, you could see, without being disrespectful, was maybe a class above or had more potential to go further at that stage. But for periods in the rounds, you were definitely in the fight. And the exchange, the final exchange, it was a real trade-off. Like, you could have been an inch either way of either of you going down.
Yeah. Would you believe I've thought about that for the last 25 years ago, 27 years ago, 28 years ago, Jeannie Mike. I've thought about that fight probably almost every day for the last 28 years, you know? It never leaves us.
How does it sit with you now?
Well, of course, I always kind of wish it was different, you know, and I wish I'd just calm down a bit and not try to knock out the number one heavyweight in the world. I wish I just relaxed more and take it easy and just moved around, not try to knock him out, which was bit of an insane, you know, but...
I've read that you spoke about when you stepped in during the first round that you felt fear. Do you think the way you fought was a reaction to that fear or...
Possibly, because, you know, as you know, mentally, I wasn't prepared for that fight.
How so?
Well, I didn't even have a mental practice, you know. I mean, now I'm 22 years sober, and that's been the biggest fight of my life. You know, I've been staying sober, but it's not even a fight. Staying sober is trying to control the thoughts in the brain, which I've been shown how to do with the 12 steps, which I wish I had back then, because they eradicate all the fear, and you're in reality. And when you're in reality, there's nothing to fear, you know. So I became completely overwhelmed. When the bell went, I could barely even walk. You know, I was like, oh, my God, you know. And I found out now that I was actually blocking all the nerves out for days before and weeks before, blocking them out, trying to shut it all off, all the noise in your head. And when the bell went, it all hit me. You know what that's like.
I know, yeah.
If you're not dealing with it, it's going to be there. So when the bell went, it all hit me, and you're in the ring with the number one heavyweight in the world. You know, it's not the best time to start losing it. You know, so I.
But you fought him. You did fight him. You weren't just in there. You know, you weren't making up the numbers.
Exactly. Yeah, I tried.
He knew you were there.
He did. He did because we've in the boxing world, you know, all these people, and he's very respectful of me, you know, and I've seen him quite a few times since, and I actually showed him the picture of I got him a great shot in the fourth round. I showed him the picture.
Right hand that we've seen in the preliminaries and now in the semifinals is something that, I don't know, seemed to come all of a sudden. Did you have it? You must have had it, but how did you develop it this well?
I've always had a pretty good punch, and
it's a good hairdo,
I've been working out on the back.
It changed a little bit as well.
So on the right, quick right after the left.
What's your big dream, Seamus?
Well, in boxing, I'd like to be world champion. I guess boxers and everything, you know, in life I'd like to maybe do something with the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, try and stop all the killing and violence.
Yeah.
Hopefully united Ireland, but, you know, we've got to try and get peace there.
Yeah.
But in boxing, I'd like to be world champion.
Yeah. Well, you're going to St. John's now?
Yeah, I'm going to St. John's.
What are you studying?
Well, I'm studying liberal arts.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to go into law, maybe. You know, I'm undecided at the moment.
Uh-huh.
But, I'm, you know, enjoying it over there. A lot of nice guys over there.
Well, I've watched your career, you know, right from the start, from the kid gloves on up. You have the desire to be a boxer, don't you? Really want to be a boxer?
Yeah, you got it's probably the hardest of all sports. You got to be.
How do you feel watching this? It's kind of a, you know, I don't know. I just in shock, really, a little bit, huh? How so?
Well, back then, you're so innocent, and you don't know what's going on, you know, and it can, you know, there's a lot, as you know, like getting into professional sports, professional boxing especially, it's so, I have to say, just so corrupt, you know. Mm. I wasn't affected that much. I mean, I didn't make a whole lot of money out of it. I'm so grateful to come out with not too much damage.
You spoke about maybe wanting to be a lawyer and studying, you know, literature and fine arts in college, and
yes.
I think you even mentioned about brokering a peace deal here when the Northern Ireland troubles. But do you have any regrets that you didn't follow those things, that you stuck to boxing? Like, looking back, how do you feel about it? Do you think you could have took it? How your life would have been different had you taken a different course?
Of course, I've thought about that often, and I actually don't regret a thing. Mm. You know, I do have to say that you know, I fought for 18 years. I mean, if you're not fighting all the time, but you're sparring a lot, you know, especially in the pros, and you do get memory loss. You know, in my last fight, I got badly beaten. I got a headbutt in the second round. I fought in a blackout for 7 or 8 rounds. I wasn't even aware that the fight was going on. I wasn't conscious. So I got battered for that. And I got the TBI, traumatic brain injury, for that in that fight. And it affected me for years. Still affects me somewhat, you know. So I've forgotten the question again.
No regrets.
Not really, no. I mean, of course, I wish I'd made more money, but that's. I know a lot of very wealthy people, and money doesn't fix anybody either, you know. But I have to say that I'm like happy, you know what I mean? Yeah. And people kind of would ask me like, "What do you do?" You know, and all I can say really is that for the last 22 years I've been sober, and some lad in San Francisco showed me how to. Because everyone has problems, you know, and this is not a therapy course here or anything, you know, but everyone has problems. But how to deal with the problems?
Mm.
And I do a writing and meditation practice. I've done it every morning for 22 and a half years. I did it this morning, and it helps your brain, which is not trained to deal with this world, you know, it helps you deal with all your problems, and then you're, you know. When you're free of problems, you can be creative and try things you want to do and do anything you want, really.
You don't have to, but can you reveal to us what you write down? Is there like a mantra, or is it personal?
No, I can reveal. It's probably never been revealed before on TV, but we'll see. The meditation, I do a meditation called Transcendental Meditation. works for some people and doesn't work for others, you know. But it worked for me, and it was a great. It's amazing. So before that, I write down basically my resentments. So when I don't get what I want, I get resentful, like a kid. We're all like big kids, actually, running around, you know, and some more than others, you know. So when I drank, all my fears were anesthetized, and it felt great. That's why people drink, because it anesthetizes their fears. But if you write down your fear, say, I have fear. Like before the morning, before this interview, I had fear I won't be able to find the gym, Carl Grady's gym. And then I have fear I always have fear I'll crash the car. I'll get on the plane, I fear the plane will crash. Because I have negative thinking. You know, it's kind of like the alcoholic way, you know, we always have negative thinking. And they're not real. But if you write them down, they start to dissipate and they don't bother you as much. So I write them all down. But I write down the resentments first. When Uncle want to get resentful, he's always be resentful at my dad, because the great guy, you know, he had 8 kids. He had a tough life. His father went to America when he was very young and was away. And when there was 5 kids and his mother passed away, had a heart attack in the kitchen, just like Dancing at Lunasa, that movie, kind of like the same thing. And they were left without a mother or a father for a long time, and his father came back and brought him to England and as a young fella, and so he had a rough life, you know, and you cannot pass on what you haven't got. So he had a rough life. So his thing was boxing, you know, so I'd be resentful at my dad. So I'd be resentful at my dad because I fear he made me box. But the most important thing is to find out what the fears are, you know. Write them down, and then I'd write down, as I said before, the fears with no resentment attached. Like, I write down, I fear I'll run out of money. I fear I'll be late for the interview with Andy Lee. It's all this stuff, you know. So you empty your brain out, and you keep writing, and you think, you start doing it first, I'll never stop. But if you keep doing it, then you say, just write them all down, and then I close my eyes and I meditate. And the feeling is as good as drinking when drinking was at its best. And that, I'm not going to lie about that.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Life after boxing.
Life after boxing was hell.
Yeah.
There's actually a phenomenon, it's not a phenomenon to me anymore, in the medical books in America, and probably over here too, called PAS, Professional Athlete Syndrome. It applies to also like people who are, even if you have a job, you know, when you retire. When you retire from boxing, I retired at 28, you know. Most people retire in the 30s or so from boxing or from sports. When you used to, my whole life was boxing in the end. So when it was gone, it's like your best friend or your best, whatever you want to call it, died. So how do you deal with that? That's why a lot of fighters end up broke, you know, drinking, you know, drugs, whatever they do, you know, crime even, you know. Because how do you replace that obsession? Because everyone in the world has the same obsession, which is to feel good. That's everyone's obsession. So it's why we work out. That's why we eat, drink. Everyone wants to feel good. Alcohol caught right to the goal of feeling good right away. So I digress as usual.
It's great.
Yeah.
How did you get into acting?
This is a funny story. Was drinking a bit in New York, and a car got towed. A car was towed about 10 times in New York, and the next day I had to go looking for the car, and I was over the place where they keep the cars. They brought them to was over on the west side of Manhattan near 34th Street. So I got over there, and I go in and I get the car, and the next day he says, "Oh, you owe a few tickets." I said, "How many?" He says, "About $1,500," and that was 20 years ago, you know, more, and probably 25 years ago. So I said, I don't have $1,500 on me right now. So I walked out of the place, and I walked to 34th and 11th. And that's Hell's Kitchen in New York. And right near the stables. I used to drive the horse and carriage around the park, and our stables is right there. So I'm going to go walk by the stables, see who was over there, because I know some friends over there. And I'm standing on the corner, 34th and 11th, and waiting for the light to change. And this, I hear this Dublin accent goes, Seamus McDonough. I'm like, who is this fella? And I look over, and some fella sitting in a car, an old car, and I say, hey. I didn't even ask him anything. I said, are you going uptown? He says, yeah. I jump in the car with him, total stranger. And it turned out to be Jimmy Smallhorn, the actor from, you know, from Love, Hate, and what's the movie that John Connors did?
Cowboy Gangsters.
Cardboard Gangsters, yes. Yeah. He says, I just got the lead in a play at the Irish Arts Centre. And I, being the grandiose, you know, person I was, I says, have they finished auditions? He says, no. So I went down the next day and I auditioned for Nye Heron, who's the assistant director on My Left Foot and all those movies with Jim Sheridan. And I auditioned and I gave me the part right away, and I started loving acting. And didn't do a whole lot of acting after that, but it kind of took off a few years ago, about 10 years ago, when I got an email from a guy in New York. He's a writer for Newsday, a sports writer, Bobby Cassidy Jr. And he says, this is the email said. He says, Seamus, hope you're well. He says, I wrote a play about my dad. My dad's supposed to play the lead. He can't do it. He's getting too old. Can you play the lead? We open in a month. I was like, okay, you know. I says, can you send me the play before I say yes? He sent me the play, and I read it. The first time I read it, I cried, you know. And we've done that about 5 or 6 times, and that's led to other things. And so,
any plans to bring that to Ireland?
We'd love to bring it to Ireland. You know, the big problem is that we have about 5 world champions in the cast, you know. It's a great play. We'd love to bring it over here. We have Michael Bent, former world heavyweight champion. Mark Breland's in it. Junior Jones is in it. Was in it, and he's not anymore. John Duddy's in it. And actually, we were doing it a few years ago, and Jimmy Smallhorn, I got him to be the director. And I played the lead, Kid Shamrock, older and younger version, but gray stuff in my hair for the older version. And we're doing it one time, and I said to Bobby Cassidy, the writer, I says, it's too much work for me to do, you know, younger and older. I says, can we get someone else to do the younger? And they said, yeah. I said, who do you think we should get? I said, can I get you John Duddy? I'll ask John Duddy. So they said, okay. So I called John, and John was about to fight you. And he leaves another story here. and he had decided not to have the fight. He's finished with boxing. So I said, John, we're doing this play. There's a part I think you'd be great at. Would you be interested in doing it? He says, yes, right away. And he was down that day to start doing rehearsals. Yeah. So John's been acting ever since. and this is a funny story. I have to believe this. After the fight, my friend Skip, I went to school with, his dad, Fred Presapia, lived in Staten Island. So we went over there to see him after the fight. And he says, Seamus, you're in Sports Illustrated. I said, great. I says, where? So he showed me, and there's a picture of me laying down and Holyfield standing up. And I said, just turn the picture around, and I'm standing up and he's laying down.
So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.